very evil. You know, very
anyway, we would, when the Concept 80 came along, we of course had, in our memory, the Project 4 vehicles that were shown many years before this. And I don't know really who came up with the idea of having another road show with these Concept 80 vehicles, but somebody came through with it. I guess it was out of marketing, or maybe Jerry was involved in that, but I'm sure, oh, I know he's involved with it, but whether it was his original concept or not, I can't quite recall. But anyway, we were given the project of coming up with a bunch of different cars that would, again, instill some confidence in the car buying public that were going to stay in business. And so there were a couple of those cars that I was extremely interested in doing, and one of them we had, because I was trying desperately to sell Jerry on a on the concept of a vehicle called a Mini Jeep. And he wasn't buying it. He had all sorts of reasons why it would conflict with the CJ5 and the 7 and the, you know, the demographics, and he was baffling me with reasons why, barraging me with reasons why this was not a good idea, that even though the gas crunch was there and all that sort of thing, that we should not even look at that thing. But anyway, he did, through through Chapin. I really had to kind of go around him a little bit, and I got Chapin on my side,
Roy Chapin
Jr., and he thought it was a good idea, and at least to the point that we were going to build up a mock-up of this thing. So we made that, we made one of those, and we had that. That was part of Concept 80. So we had that vehicle that we had looked at, and Jerry had decided in his infinite wisdom that we shouldn't build that thing or even work anymore on it. So, but we did have the car completed. The mock-up wasn't a running vehicle, but it looked, for all intents and purposes, like a real live girl car that you could walk up and turn the key and start it and drive it out of the studio. It was a very realistic model. And so we had that one. Okay, we had another car that was we were working on at that time. It was a small vehicle about the size of a, about the size of a Honda Civic, I guess, to use a reference point. It was roughly that size, maybe a little smaller. And it was a world car, and it was another one of the many things we looked at in our area. We had that, and it was a sedan. And I thought, well, maybe we can use some of that and make a van out of it. And we did exactly that. So we had a vehicle that we worked up as one of the four cars in the Concept 80 show that was programmed to be a van. So we had the Mini Jeep, and we had the van made from this other fiberglass model we had laying around. And took a lot of change to turn a Ford sedan into a van, but we did it, and it was a fun project too. And we dubbed it the Am Van, and we put in the graphics on the vehicle. It was done in a kind of a candy apple red, with some neat stripes and some neat wheels. Put some super wide tracker type wheels and tires on it, and we called it a four-wheel drive Am Van. And it was quite a small vehicle by, you know, Chrysler's Voyager standards, but a very, very handsome little car. And that car, to this day, is also up at Auto World. The reason these cars are up at Auto World is that, if I can go sideways just for a minute, is that I was involved in Auto World from the very beginning, where a friend of mine up there, Jack Scaff, who owns Scaff Carpeting, when Auto World was first conceived, he thought of me instantly on this thing and got me into this committee that was going to figure out what cars they ought to have for display up there. And that's kind of how I got involved in that setup. So, SKAFF. And Jack is he's a neat guy, and a very good friend. I've known him for a century. And he's got old antique cars and classic cars and all that sort of thing. And he's a real car buff and lives right outside of Flint. And so he got me involved in Auto World, and when I got involved in Auto World, we had a number of meetings up there that to program. I was on the acquisitions committee, the cars that they ought to pick for the Auto World program. Well, as it turned out, I don't know quite what Auto World is. If anybody asked me what it is, I couldn't tell them. It was a theme park. I couldn't tell them. It was a museum. I couldn't tell them. I don't know what it would be, but whatever it is, can you shut up just for a second? Well, whatever this is up there, it's hanging by the fingertips. They had a rough time last year, and they closed it down before the season was over. And their attendance has not been what they had programmed it to be. They've got about $70 million in this whole program up there, and they just put a Ferris wheel in the middle of the dome, and they're doing a lot of things. They've got a lot of entertainment there daily, and they've reduced the price, and they've done a lot of things to try to bring Phoenix up from the ashes there. But I don't know how ultimately it's going to work out. I enjoy it, but I don't know quite what it is. You go in there and you have kind of mixed emotions. It's the kind of thing that you go to once, but I don't think you'd go back again and again like Cedar Point or Disneyland or something like that. I don't think it has that staying power. It's too bad, because somewhere in this world there should be something that is devoted to the automobile, as that is. It's totally automobiles, but it's kind of a, I don't know, I really have a rough time criticizing it, because I don't know quite how to criticize it. The very first time I walked through there on the first night that they opened it, they had a special showing for all the people that were involved with it. And I had some strange vibrations on the thing. Well, not because half of the things weren't working when we went through, but it just, it's a funny thing. I have a difficult time articulating why it's a problem. And I think they do too. It's a funny kind of a place. It's got a lot going for it, but it's not a museum. It's not a theme park. It's not, it's a strange anomaly, or whatever the term is. But they've got old cars and new cars, and they've got a great IMAX movie up there, which is really almost worth the cost of admittance. But you see it once and that's it. And there's not much staying power. They've got some outside. I haven't been up there since then. I got a couple of tickets and Bridget Ryan sent me, but I haven't gone up there since they've reworked it, and they're now going to keep it open just for 4 months out of the year or something, rather than the full year. Although it is covered, so they could keep it open the full year, and that was the original intent to do that, so it was a year-round kind of a thing. But it really hasn't worked, and I do hope it goes, but it's in a certain amount of trouble, although they've got a lot of Mott money and so forth in the thing. I don't know. God, it's really scary to think of what they would do with it if it didn't go. But in any event, I got involved in that, and that gets back to the Concept 80 thing in a kind of a distant way, because I did talk the company into AMC into sending the Amvan, which was one of the four cars in the Concept 80 thing, up there. And again, it's a fiberglass pushmobile, let me call it that. It's beautiful, put a new paint job on it. It's got candy apple, and it says four-wheel drive Amvan, and it's in kind of a beach scene up there with a couple of mannequins and surfboards and all that sort of thing. And it's kind of a display in a full-size diorama kind of a setting. But so it's up there. Another car that I, oddly enough, happened to be the first antique car I ever owned out in California when I was out there and I first got interested in antique cars and just ruled off the California highways for hot rodding. Anyway, I slowed down and I would have taken my license. I bought a Curb-Dash Oldsmobile. I think I mentioned that earlier in one of these interviews. But anyway, that car wound up back here through a circuitous route. And that car is used, it's one of the more successful things up there. They're using it as kind of a photo car, where you walk through Auto World, and you have this Curb-Dash Oldsmobile. It's a 1905, as it turns out. And it's I restored the thing and donated it to them. And they have this little cubicle there where they have the car sitting in there with a background, and they'll loan you some clothing that's of the period of the car, veils and dusters and hats and all that sort of thing for the gals, and striped coat for the guy, and balloons and whistles and stuff for the kids. If you want to have a photograph taken in an antique car at Auto World, you can do it, and they'll set you up in this car and take your picture, and for $6 or whatever it is, they'll give you a photograph to take home to show grandma. And so that car is up there, and that is one that I was involved in, obviously. So the Amvan is up there, the Wedge is up there, and the Curb-Dash Old. So it's three of the about 23 cars or whatever they've got up there are ones that I was involved with. So anyway, back to the Concept 80. So we had this, we did the Amvan, and those two cars that I mentioned at this point, up to this point, the Mini Jeep, which was spit and polished, cleaned up and shown, along with the Amvan, were half of the cars in the Concept 80. The other two cars were, again, one of the other of the two cars that I mentioned was a small car, and we never really had a name for it, but it was a two-door, and it had retractable lights, and at the time, that is sleeping headlights. And it was a lot of glass. It looked like a little brother to a Pacer. It wasn't that round. It was more squared off, and it was a two-box type vehicle and a little hatch in the back. But it was a kind of a handsome little car. And we had that. Again, it was a serious proposal that we'd made to management, but it was laying around, hadn't been scrapped or cut up, so we took that and dusted it off and made a lot of changes to it. And used that as another portion of the Concept 80 show. So that was three. Well, the fourth one was a vehicle again that we had kind of laying around down in the storage area, and it was on a Gremlin wheelbase, but it had a sportabout or a station wagon lift deck on the back, a full lift deck. So that car we called the GT, and we put a special front end, a special grill on it, a special interior, and a super green paint job. And it's a one-off car, and that car is still around. Well, all these, let's see, I think all four of them still live somewhere. I think they're in storage down in Toledo or something. But anyway, the GT was just that. It was this company still has them. They're down there. And anyway, that it wasn't all that radical. You know, I always felt that I would like to have had much more contemporary proposals for this this Concept 80 show, but it just was not in the cards. We couldn't do it because we didn't have the time. We had to do this thing in like 90 days or something, or less than that. And because they had, you know, our marketing friends and PR were all hyped up about this thing, and they said, hey, you got to get these cars out, and geez, you're pushing us. And on top of that, we had the production cars to do, so we had to use this as a kind of not a fill-in, but an addition to the vehicles we were already working on. So anyway, somehow we did it with overtime and a lot of guys working their tails off, and so we had these four cars, and that was Concept 80, and it went over very well. It was shown again. Jerry did his dog and pony act at the microphone, and we showed it in New York, and it's kind of a repeat, really, of Project 4, but done for different reasons and different purposes, and the results were different. Not bad. They were all good. These programs are good things to do because they instill confidence in the Wall Street group, as well as the car buying public and the dealers, of course. It helps their morale. So anyway, that was that one. But in the last few years, once Renault came in, of course, they're 46% stockholder in the company, and they want to be very influential with the cars that we build. And of course, we got into the Alliance program, which was the first one. That car was being built, although when I first saw it wasn't being built. This I first got my look at the 9, as it's called over there, and I first got my the first time I saw the car, I thought it looked more American than European, and I still think that. But it was done by Alpron, and of course the die was cast on that one, and Jerry Myers was, of course, at the helm. Alpron is the director. Over there, a director is the equivalent of a VP in this country. He was my counterpart at Renault, at Rouet.
O-P-R-O-N.
Alpron. Pronounced Alpron. It's my guy. I forget about that. I guess. Well, yeah, that was. But anyway, he's not there anymore. He was displaced from his position here about a year ago. And the big shakeup, shootout at the OK Corral. He's out. I don't know what the hell he's doing, but Renault never fire anybody. They just put him aside, and I don't know what they do. But he's still wandering around there, still at his office. But Juche is the guy that's Gaston Juche, who Alpron had hired. No, take that back. They hired Alpron from Peugeot and brought him in and put him over Juche, who was in charge of Renault styling. And now Juche is back at the helm, and Alpron is off twiddling his thumbs in an office somewhere around there. So Juche got his job back, in effect. J-U-C-H-E-T. Juche Gaston. Nice guy. Very nice guy. Very talented, and speaks some English. Speaks a little bit more than Alpron does. And then they have another guy over there by the name of Jack Noche. N-O-C-H-E-T. And we call them Juche and Noche. And they're both very excellent designers, particularly, they're both good. I couldn't give a plus to one over the other. Noche is going to retire here shortly, I think. He's going to, over there, they retire everybody at 60. You just don't work past that. And it isn't a bad idea. And I'd have been out a year earlier if we'd had that in effect here. But anyway, Jerry was in charge of the once Renault came into the act, and of course Jerry was instrumental in doing that, because he felt with the gas crunch and everything that was happening, this is years ago, he wanted to ally ourselves with somebody that had front-wheel drive technology, or at least lightweight car technology and light engines, and he looked at a number of companies, and someday in his memoirs he may tell us who he looked at, but he was in constant contact with a lot of people to effect some kind of a marriage or merger or alliance, pardon the pun, mm-hmm. with another company in order to let us survive, because we didn't have the manpower facility, we didn't have the financial facilities, back the muscle to go out and invent a front-wheel drive car, and of course we knew many years ago that that was coming. And so Jerry did put together the thing with Renault, and because he was so instrumental with that and working with Bernard Hinault, they put this merger together. It isn't a merger, I should call it that, but this arrangement together. And I heard about it fairly early in the program, in the negotiations, and then in fact did get over a couple of times to see this car that we were going to build in this country, ultimately to be called the Alliance. And it was not built, of course, in France at that time. And the 9 over there was to be between, it was really kind of a low-priced car, and is today not an expensive car. It doesn't command in the theme of things or the strata of vehicles. It's not a car that's upgraded as it is in this country now that it's become an Alliance. And in France, as an example, the 9 over there really is kind of a cut above the R5, the old R5 when it was introduced. And it was the car that the guy stepped up to when he got through with his R5, wanted to trade in, wanted to upgrade his vehicle, he would step up to an R9. And at that time I also saw the 11, which turns out to be the Encore. And we had plans to bring that in, or build it here too. And that's ultimately what we did. We do that right now. But in the early stages of when I first saw the Alliance, I was taken with it. Unlike a lot of people who didn't really like it very much, I thought the car looked, quite American. I was a little too severe and too crisp and too many square corners on it for my taste, but it was too late. It was fait accompli, to use the French term. It was really, really over. I couldn't do anything about that, and Jerry wouldn't let me do anything about very much at all, because he said, "No, we're going to build this car in Kenosha, and I don't want you to screw around with it, Teague. What I want you to do is upgrade the interior. You got to keep all the exterior surfaces. The only place you're going to have to change the car is to add a two-door to the line, which they don't build. They only build it in four-door form, just a four-door. And he said you can do it. Oh, God, this had to be, I don't know, 4 years ago. Yeah, about four and a half years ago. It was after the arrangement was completed, and they bought into the company at 46% and all that stuff. And it was all about that same general time frame. He said all this was happening. And he said, "Don't screw with the car, T. We're going to get a car in here, and you're going to do exactly the same automobile. You can't change anything. Change the grill." And I did talk him into putting quad headlights in it, which they finally, the French liked so well, they put it on some of their 9s and 11s over there, particularly the 11. But because I could see that those quad headlights, they had the European headlight, which was illegal in this country, so we had to change the headlights anyway. And so I said, "Hey, what we ought to do is put a nice, clean horizontal grill." You know, I didn't have much to work with. God, I had to change. I had to hold all the front end sheet metal. I of course did change the bumpers because they had these funny, and still have these funny kind of plastic bumpers on the 9 and the 11 over there. And as I said, but over there it's a cheap car. It's not an upgraded car like we're building here. And they just didn't want to put the money into it because it was not meant for that kind of a price range and that kind of a demographic group as a step up from the 5. That's what it is over there. Here it's a different kind of an animal. And so we put a lot of money into the Alliance, a lot more money, you know, particularly in the interior and so forth. And they have a 14-inch wheel option, and they have 13s as normal. And we changed the grill, and we added a two-door sedan to the lineup, which they liked very much. They thought we'd done a great job on the two-door version of it. But God, you know, it wasn't very satisfying. You know, here you got a car that's handed to you on a plate, and just go ahead and, you know, Xerox it in your styling area. And yeah, you can put a new grill on it, and yeah, if you want four headlights, that's a good idea to do that. And you got to change the taillights because you got to meet the ETL requirements for, you know, for taillights in this country, and you have headlights too. That's where I got the four headlights. And don't you know, and then the product planners, of course, got in the act, and they said, hey, you can't afford four headlights on the car. So one time we damn near lost that one, but we didn't. In fact, we did lose it this next year in 86 because we were going back to a single headlight in the Encore. But that's not going to hurt it because it's a squared off light, and it's a good looking front end, I think. Even though it doesn't have four lights, it's got two, but they look good. But anyway, we did the Alliance. I think I say modestly for my group that worked on that car that we did the car of the year, so it couldn't be all that bad. And we knew from the beginning, not talking styling now, but we knew damn well that little 1.4 engine wasn't really gonna wanna do it too well. And the car really was kind of and is now the 1.4 really, in my opinion, is almost unacceptable from a performance standpoint, but it gets fantastic mileage because little engine, but it won't really, particularly the automatic, won't really pull your hat off your head by any means. But in any event, that was not my problem. But I'm interested in the subject anyway, particularly the automatic, which has got too much vibration when it idles at stall speeds are bad. But anyway, we did the car with a mandate that thou shalt not change the exterior surfaces of that car, but thou shall be able to do a two-door version of it, which we did, which meant a longer door and a different quarter panel. Yay, boo, you know. That's a great idea, but, you know, boo, you can't do a lot with holding that amount. But we couldn't change the taillight, we couldn't change the roof, we couldn't change the backlight, we couldn't change the deck lid, we couldn't change the taillights and the bumpers, of course, are carryover from the Alliance. So, you know, we had a chance to, you know, really vent our creative spleens by just doing a two-door version of the four-door. And those things are, I'm only mentioning all these things that, you know, it was about that time that I started getting really discouraged, and I started thinking about early retirement because of that. God, if it's going to be this way, if we're going to have cars handed to us from France, and, you know, what are they using me for? They don't need me. I'm a little more creative than that, and it's been bugging me for quite a while, even before the Renault thing came through the door. But we did, on the bright side, we did have a chance to do there. We'd been working on the XJ, which the French didn't like very much anyway. They had another car they were going to do called the VBA. But anyway, they had, when this thing started with American Motors, they were doing a car over in by Gandini, which was really, we didn't know it at the time, but it was really kind of a competitive car against the XJ, which we call it internally, which wound up being the Wagoneer and the Cherokee, the one that's on the road now. But they had done this car over there, and it was done by Gandini. They do a lot of farming out. Gandini, Gandini. He's in Torino, and he has his own shop over there, and they almost completely own him as far as his design outfit is concerned. I don't even know if he works for anybody else. He's kind of an advanced design group for the Rouet group. And they also, traditionally, Renault have worked with a lot of people outside of their own home base design group. They've worked with Gandini and the Bellini brothers, who the hell ever they are. I never really met them, but they used to do some horrid things. And, of course, they've worked with Giugiaro. And then there's another outfit in the western part of France that... I'm trying to think. I never got over there. I was invited a couple times, but I never got over there. It was about a helicopter ride from Paris. Rouet is that's just on the outskirts of Paris, and that's where they have their tech center. The engineering and styling is all right there. I don't know how the hell you spell it. It ends with a T. Yeah, that's right. And anyway. That's Renault's Tech Center, and where they have their main styling group, which comprises about 112 people. It's the last count I got, but they've been cutting back, so I don't know what it is now. So, anyway, we had done the XJ, and we did a clinic in Paris and Zurich, and also Zurich, and we did a couple of them in this country too. And with very great results. We knew going in that the XJ was going to be a success. And Jerry was, these clinics are market surveys where you get, you know, 400 or 500 people in, and you ask them what they think, and you ask them some very programmed questions, and they give you the results of what they think with their now eyes, not their future eyes, but their now eyes, as I call it, which kind of bothers me a little bit because I don't really think you get a very concise reading of some guy that isn't very knowledgeable in the automobile world looking at something that's a way out car. He's not going to like it because it doesn't look like the one he drove in the parking lot with.
You're not alone.
Yeah, so anyway, but they're good. I'm not suggesting eliminating marketing surveys because they're very good, but I think you ought to use your own good judgment as automobile people as to what the bottom line is. You can look at, get their input, that's fine, and that helps, and that's good, and it's good to get kind of a reading. But if you get some guy that's a plumber or some housewife that that takes washing in on Fridays, that's going to tell you what the car of 19-3 years away is going to be, I think if you put all your hopes on those answers, you're going to... Yeah, I wish you hadn't. But in any event,
in this case, they were right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were. They've been right, I guess. Well, if you have good enough products that you put in there and you don't much care, you know, what they think, you can get their reading. And, you know, if they like a taillight that's horizontal versus vertical and you agree with that, well, whether you agree with it or not, it's probably going to happen if it gets all the votes. But anyway, the XJ was very well received from the very beginning, the first. Design concepts, and more importantly, in this case, the clinic results. It was overwhelming, and it beat the VBA, and it beat the other cars. Tajaro did one too, by the way. He did a version of the XJ, and we beat him that time too. But we haven't beat him lately because he's on a roll. Exactly. Well, he's a damn good designer, I'll tell you. To beat him, we beat him actually three times. He had a proposal for the XJ, and we beat him on that one. And of course the AMX-3 was in the contest there. And there were two or three other times that we beat him, but the last two he's come out on top. As if you take the results of the clinic as the last end-all word, that they liked his car better than they liked our car. The one we did in Dallas on an X-58 program, which is going to be built in 1988 over in Canada. That was a horse race. He beat us, but not by much. And I guess they picked the right car. I hope they did, because I'm looking forward to getting pension checks for the rest of my life. But it's a good-looking car in any event. I don't think it's as new as it should be. Even our car wasn't as new as it could have been, although one of them was really good. But you show a kind of a, you know, a really new-looking car to 400 or 500 people, and they're going to be influenced to some degree, and I'm no psychologist, but they're going to be influenced by some degree by the things that they like. If they like an old Sierra, and they're driving an old Sierra, they're going to take the one that they think is the most like the old Sierra in the group, because they really can't project themselves that far into the future. Now, that isn't a blanket statement, a stereotype of all the people that are in the clinic, because there's some very bright people, and you have these things called focus groups, where you have some of the people that are, you know, are either not necessarily in the business, but that they're associated with the high-tech groups in Dallas particularly. I met when I was quite impressed by a lot of the people that were in the focus groups. That's where you have a closed-circuit TV, and you're in the other room, and you watch these guys. You have 10 to 12 people around the room, and they have one of the guys that runs the thing, in this case, Oxley Smith, and it's Stu Long, who's a very articulate, very good man as far as asking questions to draw people out on what they think. And I've sat through a number of those things in the next room and watched it. And you see the range, the gamut. You get a guy, one guy was a dope addict, a guy was stoned absolutely out of his tree. And so he was in one of those sessions, and they give him $25 or something to do it. And it takes 3 hours, or sometimes 3 hours to
name the firm that does it.
Oxtoby Smith. They're out of New York, and they're a very, very competent group. And there's another one here in town that do this sort of thing. Well, there's quite a number of them that put on these clinics for us. OXTOBY and Smith. And they do a really good job. I mean, they have a computer readout on the results. They ask the respondents, as they call them, to make this, you know, 15, 20 page thing out, put X's in the right spot, and then they calculate, you like this car best. How do you relate this to the other car that's a reference car? And you think it's, would you buy that car? Would you buy this car? It's very complex and very involved, and takes a lot. And I'm just astounded that people take as much time going through those things as they do for a cup of coffee and a handshake and a donut, you know. And that's why some get 10 out. It depends on who's putting it out. But if, on the focus groups, they get more. They get like $25.
Just an officer.
I never got involved in how much they gave them, but I know there is a stipend that they give these people.
The code for this is the X-58?
Yeah, it's
which
the
is the next generation alliance?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's a bigger car.
Oh, it's new?
Yeah, it's all new. Tire tread up. There's no carryover.
87?
88. And, it's a very good-looking car. It's typical Jujaro. As I say, we had a couple of our proposals, and Jujaro had one, and there was another proposal from a California consultant. Yeah, just to complete the previous subject before we get on to another one here briefly, there was a California consultant group that had a proposal for the Dallas. It was a year ago last March that this happened, and I was there, and it was a very well conducted market survey, and there were about 400, as I recall, maybe 450 total respondents that came in to the auditorium where he had these cars positioned. And at one time, the first couple of days, in fact, it started on a Sunday, and Sunday and Monday, one of our two proposals was winning the race. But the thing that clinched it was that this particular car, and I'm not saying anything out of school here at all, but Jujaro's car had very much of an Audi type of a feeling, an ambiance to it. It looked like an Audi 5000, and that's a damn good-looking car. This car looks like it would be in that lineup. If it was another car in the Audi showroom, it would be this car because it looked very similar to it. It didn't have the third one on the side and so forth, but it was very similar in its total reflective personality of an Audi.
Ford's bringing out an Audi type this fall.
Yeah, that's right, the Taurus. But this car did reflect that. In fact, a lot of the people that looked at this car, and I mean a lot of them, they would ask them who they thought would be building this car. And we had an Audi there for reference at one point, and they thought it was an Audi type proposal. So it had that going for it, and I'll tell you, that's not to be sneezed at because that's a really good-looking car. And his car was very good-looking, but it looked very much like a version of an Audi with a little different upper structure and a little different body section and some other detail changes. But a lot of the people who looked at that car were guessing that it was an Audi-type proposal. And, of course, when we were winning, they hadn't really told the viewers what the price of this car was. Well, when they put the price there, which was a very low price, then the people said, hey, you know, if I can get an Audi for, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 less than an Audi is, I'm going to vote for that car. And that's exactly what happened.
So you think it was just like rigged?
So, yeah, and our car was, well, it wasn't really rigged. I can't honestly say that. Because there were facts that they were showing there. They were saying that, hey, this car is going to sell for X number of dollars. And our car is going to sell for X number of dollars. But because of the influence of the Audi look that this car had, that Jujaro, and this isn't sour grapes at all, because, God, I think they made the right decision, which is strange for me to say, because we had two cars in there. He had one, and there was a California deal. So I'm being very objective about it, and it's a little painful to do that because you don't like to lose. But nonetheless, that car did have a definite Audi expensive look to it. And how do you explain expensive look? It's the vibes that you get by knowing that an Audi is an expensive car, and you know that it's a good-looking car. You like the looks of it. Well, it's had all those things going for it, and ours did too, but I probably made a strategic error because we were pushed very hard by product planning. I mean, very hard by product planning. Maury, my friend Maury, it said, hey, you know, he liked the looks, he was from GM, okay, and he liked the looks of the Sierra and the C-body Chrysler, or the C-bodied GM cars. And he's very much GM-oriented. He knew what they were doing for 3 years ahead, and he's only been there a couple of years. So he knew what they had in the skunkworks over there. And so he was pushing me very hard to get kind of an American look. And Jujaro, being Italian and being European, automatically made his car look European. And I automatically, although I could have switched horses, and I'm sure he could have too, I could have had more of a European look in the cars that we were doing, both of them. But I elected not to, and that probably was a strategic error on my part. But, you know, you can't forecast what's going to happen a year ahead. Or this was only about 6 months, actually, but we, because the program was moved up. But anyway, our cars had a definite next-generation American look. Jujaro had a current-generation Audi look. And when they put the price tag out there and said, hey, this car's going to sell for X number of dollars, and that X number of dollar figure is a hell of a lot less than the Audi is, the guys would look at them and say, Jesus, I like that American car. It's fine. And it's great, and that's the sort of thing that I like. But God, if I can get an Audi for this kind of an Audi-looking car for this kind of figure, I'm going to vote that way. And that's exactly what happened. And he beat us, but not by much. It was really a horse race. It was like, you know, 9-10 or something. You know, it really was that close.
In the decision to choose one over the other, they certainly depend on the surveys. But what other factors go into design decisions?
Well, by the time you get to that decision, it really is a beauty contest. It really is. It's a beauty contest and a cost contest. You know,
but yours would cost out.
Oh yeah, the cars, either Jujaro's car or our car would have cost the same. The bottom line, the sticker price on the window would have been the same. But that price was much less than an Audi sells for today. And given the choice, as I say, repeating myself, but given the choice of getting an Audi for $4,000 or $5,000 less than an Audi cost, that looks like an Audi vehicle, versus a Sierra-looking vehicle or a, pick a name, Buick, top-line Buick, that a certain group of those, particularly the considerers that were driving foreign cars, or the considerers who were looking at a new car, they have instilled in their mind, and know and have seen enough Audis, particularly in Dallas. They've seen enough of those cars around that's very influential, because they know A, that it's an expensive car, and B, that it's a good-looking car, damn good-looking car, flush glass and all that. And this car had all of those features, and you know, and the price, given price guesstimate, was very much less than that. So that really swung the vote. If there was any one factor that swung the votes on that whole marketing survey, that was it.
Can you describe your design for posterity?
Well, it had flush glass, which of course is, I was just looking at some photographs before I left AMC of that car, in fact the car is still around down there, I haven't cut it up yet, but it was a very, very good looking car, and it had a lot of Bob Nixon in it, it had some Dick Teague, and it had a lot of people involved in it, Jack Kemp's. And it wouldn't have been a mistake to build that car. In fact, Jose said the same thing. He said, that's a really good looking car. He's already taken it. But it looked like a next generation. It had quite a GM look, only because none of us, well, I worked at GM, and a lot of us did, but this is a long time ago. And we know, of course, what they're doing and what they have on the road today. And, you know, Sierra's a hell of a long ways from the Sierra body. C-body, so-called. But that's a long ways from flush glass. It's got a very heavy step and a very heavy belt. This had none of that. It was very clean and simple. It was an aircraft-type canopy thing, and it had a kind of a stiff C-pillar, a little bit stiff, but not too stiff. And it was very aerodynamic, had a very low snout and radius fenders and things of that type.
Have you kept the drawings or the photographs from that project?
No, I don't really have anything from that. I just felt obligated not to bring anything home from that program. I kind of wish I had been a little more dishonest, I guess, and walked off with some of those from my memoirs, but I didn't do it. I felt that, you know, by the time I, you know, do... I am in a position to talk about it in much more detail. The years will have gone by, and the Brampton car will be out and so forth, and then I'm sure I can get photographs of that thing, because there were plenty of them taken. But I guess, in retrospect, I wish I had, snaked out a few of them, because it wouldn't have really hurt anything, and if I kept them under the covers for a long time, it really wouldn't have mattered much, I guess. But I don't know, I just didn't do it. I never walked off with anything around the plant there the office that it wasn't history. I've got a lot of AMX stuff, and nobody cares about that anymore, and a lot of Pacer stuff and a lot of other things. But in reflecting back, I guess, over the years, if I have any regrets, I guess, I don't know, I wish I'd been able to do more. I guess if I'd turned the calendar, the pages back, and we had never done the Pacer, and we had been associated with Renault, I would have had the access to me of doing, having lighter weight components to put in that car, because conceptually the Pacer still has a lot of things today. If you look at any car that you want to look at, the belts are lower, the glass is greater, the snouts are lower, the aerodynamic, the cars are wide for their length and their height. There's a lot of things in the Pacer that conceptually had the limousine type doors without drip moldings and the drips inside and so forth. So there were a lot of concepts in the Pacer that really are happening today, you know, 10 years later. And I guess if I have any regrets is that the Pacer couldn't have happened with more of the technology that is here today, but you can't put the years ahead that way. I knew when I was involved in the Pacer that it should have been front-wheel drive, it should have been lighter, but we just simply didn't have the componentry to work with. But that car is an example with some of the French front-wheel drive technology applied to it, and the lighter, their computer-designed body structures, and the total vehicle, I think, and if I could have, I never won the battle with Jerry on that one. I was always aghast at the bumpers that were on that car. They bothered me every time I see a Pacer today. It just ticks me off because he was on this cheap kick again of, you know, having got it one time, you want to make the bumpers interchangeable, you know, front and rear. And the whole bumper concept on that car is bad, 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 bad. And it could have been cleaned up and simplified, and you know, urethane bumpers were in at that time. We could have done it, except there was a cost thing again that Jerry kept throwing at me. As it was, the car was expensive, but it had a lot of cheap things on it, like the bumpers. Bumpers are the biggest, that and the width of the car, it became 4 inches wider because of my friend Siegel. Again, he seemed to haunt me through a lot of years there. But because he was, at one point in his career, he was in charge of go between Washington and letting us know what the things that were coming out of Washington were going to be and how they were going to manifest themselves in our production vehicles. And he was convinced in his own mind that we were going to have cars that had this enormous beam in the side of it for side impact with the 18-inch pole and all that stuff. And none of that happened, or not none of it. Well, some of it happened, but not to the degree that he was waving all the red flags about. And we wound up making that car 4 inches wider than it ever should have been or ever was conceived to be. Yeah, well, that's on the outside. The inside was fine, but the doors are so goddamn thick on it, you know, and they're so heavy.
And the glass area, too, was a bit.
The glass was not that much of a weight problem. It really wasn't. I was hit with that many times by the engineers, and finally I had one of my engineers that worked for me at the time calculate what that weight difference was between that car. Say we raised the belt 3 inches, you know, to have less scale gas. And it was like about 8 pounds. You know, it was nothing. I mean, it was really a minuscule amount. So the glass really, well, everybody thinks of glass as being heavy, and it is, but if you have more glass, you have less sheet metal. And, you know, it's a trade-off, and you figure the difference between the two. In the case of the Pacer, it was about 8 pounds. Less than that, it was 7.9 or something, as I recall.
I was thinking of the area in terms of concern.
Yeah, there was the bug that we did when we did the Pacer clinics down in Atlanta, one of them. We did get some glitches on that thing. They said, well, glass is, you know, they're still going back to the plate glass days, and they think, oh, glass is dangerous. Well, it really isn't. But there were some psychological objections to the amount of glass in that thing, and sun load, too, heat. That's why almost all of the cars, you know, almost all the Pacers we've built, God, I can't even remember seeing one that wasn't air-conditioned. But that solves that problem. You know, the got cars today have got proportionate amounts of glass that are equal to the Pacer, too. So,
that's pretty ahead of its time.
It really was.
Was that pretty much your design without the
glitches? Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was one that I can get blamed or credit for. In this case, blame, I guess.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Had that car. See, it originally started out as a rotary front-wheel drive engine car, working with GM. I think I mentioned that in some of the earlier talks we had about this thing. But we were working with GM on their rotary engine, and the car was 4 inches narrower, but it had the same interior width. That was the key. But it had the 2-inch less thick doors on both sides, 4 inches. And it had a much cleaner front, had retractable headlights, had a very clean, simple grille on it. It was destined to be at one point in time, a rotary engine, front-wheel drive vehicle. And it would have been, you know, it was much lighter. We didn't have to, at that point, we were not considering using all of the big six-cylinder engine, which is a tried-and-true damn good engine, but way heavy. And the heavier suspensions off the Matadors and Ambassadors and things like that, and the differentials and all of the driveline and everything, bigger brakes, everything. So it, but it, the concept initially was fantastic, but the workout was not. And it just fell apart at the seams.
But
yeah, it is. Well, we had committees, and we had financial constraints too. We just, you know, and then GM backed out of the rotary engine thing right in the middle of the stream. So that.
What happened there?
Well, they were in this Wankel engine or rotary engine
thing,
and they dropped the whole program. I don't know who originally started that. I guess it was Ed Cole, or I don't know who started working with Wankel originally.
Yeah.
But we were working with them, and we had all the package drawings. In fact, we had an early prototype engine that we were going to put into a mule. And they dropped out of the program.
I mean, I never understand why.
I don't know. Well, they were having seal problems. Of course, Mazda went ahead and solved that one.
Solved it, yeah.
And, geez, the rotary engine today is, you're going to see a lot of them.
Coming back, although Mazda only uses it on the RX.
Yeah, in this country, they use it on the RX-7, but in Europe, they have a sedan over there that's, it's an exotic, expensive sedan that they build over there that has a rotary engine, triple rotary, I think it is. So they...
The specs always sound impressive.
Right, and the mileage has never been real swift, even on the RX-7, so it... But they've solved the seal problem, the wipe seal, and then also there's a main bearing seal too, I guess, which I'm not that familiar with.
There's a new RX-7 just come out.
Yes, there is.
So you're a prophet without honor as far as the pacer went.
I guess, but at one point in time, I really wanted to do, bouncing back to Concept 80, I really wanted to do, and we just didn't, this plane flat ran out of time, I wanted to do a Concept 80 lightweight pacer-ish kind of a car. Fix the bumpers, number one. Fix the width, number two. And promote that car as a kind of a Pacer 2, if you will, that would be roughly the same interior package, not exactly, but roughly, and much lighter weight, and a smaller car to a degree, not quite a bit smaller, but narrower certainly, and with a front wheel drive concept, like it was originally. What I really want to do, and I bounced this off of Jerry and shot me right out of the water, I wanted to do one of the Concept 80 cars. I wanted to take the time, and we just plain, and that's, of course, the reason that he used. He said, well, we haven't got time for that, T. You've got to model it, you've got to cast it, you got to do all. And he said, take that other one over there and do that third car and make that your thing. Well, that, but that, I couldn't get a Pacer look on it. And I wouldn't have gotten that much of a Pacer look anyway, but I would have had a lot of those concepts involved in this theoretical Concept 80 vehicle, which didn't happen. But anyway, if there's any regrets, I guess it's that the Pacer really was never what it started out to be, and never really made it to the starting line the way it was conceived.
As a concept, it had a lot of
conceptually it did have a lot of it. And I guess when the history books are written 50 years from now, there'll be, well, there's a Pacer Owners Club somewhere over in Chicago, or a Collectors Club or something. But we still build a hell of a lot of those cars. I think when Kefton was there, I asked him to check on that, and I can't recall precisely how many cars, but it was well over 250,000 cars that we built of Pacers, and that's a lot of cars.
When did they drop it?
In the 70s. Yeah, even Jerry came through at one point. The car was heavy enough to begin with. And then Jerry came through at one point and put a V8 in the damn thing. And boy, that drove guys right up the wall, including me. And I had to put a hood on that thing because he didn't want to pay for fenders. And so we had a hood only. And then it was a reworked inner hood, by the way. But anyway, a new outer skin he would give me. Yay, yay, wonderful. And a new grill. And we put this all I could do in order to package the engine out of the hood is to bring it up in the middle. And, I couldn't span it between the headlights, which is what I wanted to do. We made a show car. I was trying to convince him I had tried these end runs on them, but it never got off the ground because of financial constraints. But when we put the V8 in the thing, it made a heavy car even heavier. And, that was compounding the felony. But he was, for some reason or other, he had guys jumping through hoops around that place to stuff in that V8 engine in that Pacer, and it should never have happened. There's a few of them around still, but they're way overweight up in that weight. Distribution is bad on the car. The engine was heavy, quite a bit heavier than that. Six, I think, 100 some pounds. And that was all over the front axle, which forced a lot of things, and brakes and drive lines. But anyway, we did a V8 Pacer.
Mm. And Myers turned out to be chairman of the board.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a lot of things that were not that swift that didn't matter, I guess.
What about the Wagoneer and the Cherokee, which are really red motor? I never saw that come about.
The new one, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that was a program that started under Jerry, and we had two programs going there. We had one which was called the Wagoneer 2, and that was a bigger car. And looking back on it, in retrospect on that one, that's one we should have built, because that was like an XJ, but it was wide. It had all the problems fixed, and it was the first one. It had all the problems fixed that are problems today on the XJ. It had two damn, the current XJ, in my view, for a four-door, has got too damn small and narrow a door in the back for climbing in and out. This had more wheelbase, and it was only like about 75 pounds heavier. I just looked that up before I left, because I thought, God, you know, it's... I've got pictures of that one. That I do have. That one alongside of the XJ. We did the SJ2, it was called. Senior Jeep 2. And that was before we started work on the XJ. But then the fuel thing came across, and we had a chief engineer there, Roy Lund, that was against the SJ2 from the beginning. It had a frame underneath it. It had independent front suspension. It was a slightly bigger car. With all of that, it was under 100 pounds. I don't hold me to the exact figure, but it was under 100 pounds projected weight versus the XJ that finally happened. It was a little more wheelbase, just enough to get you a good door in the back. It had independent suspension, as I say, in the front, which the XJ doesn't have. It's a stiff axle. They put all these track bars in to keep the things in place, and it's a good riding car, but it's very expensive to put that suspension there, more than a front wheel, more than a four-wheel independent suspension. The car was a much, much better package, much better. And we were well along with that car when it was canceled. You know, Jerry canceled that thing because he was convinced by Roy Lund that the car was too big, and it really wasn't that much bigger. And so we did this miniaturized version of it, which turned out to be the XJ, which is a very successful car, don't get me wrong. But the thing that killed the SJ2, the one that the program we were working on, was the fact that we had some input from Bracco and the Blazer, that it was going to be a downsized car, again, made from a truck, both of those. And we were just too big with the SJ, and we really were not too big, because we were just about the size, you know, total volume size, surface-wise, of the current large antique Wagoneer that we built today, the Wagoneer Limited. It was generally, but a much cleaner, the curved side. But, well, it had a lot of XJ, I mean, the XJ had a lot of the SJ2 blood in it. But the SJ2 was a much better car. We should really have built that, because it gave us V8 capability. That was another thing that Jerry didn't want. It had the straight six or the V8. And when the XJ came along, we were looking for an engine bigger than the four-cylinder, which was scheduled to be built, the four-cylinder version of the six, straight six. That's the one that's in the XJ right now. And so we needed something bigger than that. Well, they couldn't put the V8 in the Wagoneer. It just wouldn't package. So now, in a year from now, you're going to see a year and a half, I guess it is, you're going to see the straight line inline six in the current XJ or our current Wagoneer. But back when this was happening, that the SJ2, which never happened but went a long way towards happening, was had a six-cylinder base and the V8 option. And they could have done a lot of things with the V8 and the total V8. It really should have happened. That would have been a much more successful car, even than the XJ. When the XJ is very successful, but we would have had a leg up on Blazer, and that was the argument that I used. Right. We would have had a leg up on both Blazer and Bronco because it was a slightly larger car. It had about 2 inches more shoulder room in the back, which the car could use, the XJ could use today. And it had about 4 inches more wheelbase, and 4 inches, consequently 4 inches longer door in the back, which would have really been a much better package than the current XJ. We've been criticized by that on that subject.
Yeah.
And of course the independent suspension and the frame and all that stuff was and with all of that, because they wound up with a damn, and it would have been a much simpler program to do a truck off of, because right now we're going to have a Comanche that has gone through all kinds of tremendous growing pains in order to make a truck on a, you know, nobody, hardly anybody in that size truck, certainly nobody, makes a body frame truck. They had to add sills to that Comanche truck that's on the road and they're building right now, or starting to. That thing was an enormous vehicle, enormous number of problems involved. and even getting prototypes to stay together, because they wound up almost literally adding a frame to that car in order to get a truck off of it. It really is a frame. It's welded on, you know, in the cab area, and it's actually a frame. They don't call it that. They call it box member, side sills or whatever. But it really is a frame, and the truth is known. And that the SJ wouldn't have had that problem because it had a frame under it to begin with. And so anyway, that was one thing that I regret. I wish that had happened. And if it had happened, I know we'd be in better shape. We wouldn't be scurrying now to do a replacement for the XJ, which is just about the dimensions, by the way,
really?
The one that's in the works right now of the original SJ.
Oh my.
It's got the door fixed. It's got the width fixed. It's got the overhang fixed.
Hmm.
It will not have any independent suspension. But
it's frustrating.
So anyway, but you know, I couldn't win the battle with the engineers and the product planners, because the product planning mentality is that whatever the other guy's got, you ought to have one just like it, and that's not the way it should be. You should know what they're doing and then change it enough to improve it, but not be, you know, dead cold on it. But the product planning mentality is they look down a list of cars that are selling and say, hey, this is a hot market right here now, not 3 years from now, and this is the kind of car we ought to do, T, or whoever's there. And they're copycats, you know. They're averagers. And you know, Chuck Jordan, for one, is, you know, he hates product planners with a passion, and he calls them a bunch of copycats, and they're bookkeepers. You know, I can't make that statement, because they're a very helpful group of guys, and they're wonderful as far as figuring out options and inclusions of various things in vehicles and lineups and competitive data and all that stuff. But don't let them get in the creative end of it, and they have, unfortunately. Over at Ford, where they've gotten a hell of a lot smarter than anybody so far. And GM, of course, has been smart all along. They haven't let the product planners dictate what the cars look like. But at Ford, they now have come out of that morass that they were in, and they now have a design planning group over there under Kopka. And that's a smart move, because they can get the guys with the clipboards and the funny little ties that walk around with their, you know, telling all the designers that I like that, raise that, lower this, do this. Here's a, you know, that it's screwing up. And Ford went through that, and they're out of it now. That's why they got some good looking cars coming out, because they let product planning do what they should do and do well and are very helpful at, but keeping the hell out of the creative end of it.
If you would be asked, as I'm asking you to do in a short time, to sum up your design career, how would you do it?
I don't know. I don't have a lot of regrets. I've got little regrets, and I mentioned most of those, but I've been really indeed fortunate, I think, in working for a couple of really neat companies. I've worked for a lot of them. I started out years ago doing a little work for Kaiser Fraser, and then, of course, I went from there to GM, and from GM to Packard, and then Packard to Chrysler for a year, which I detested. And then, you know, the last 25 years, 25 and a half to the day, I've worked at American Motors up until last March. And it's been a really interesting career. I have no regrets. I've done what I've wanted to do and what I've liked to do and what I've enjoyed doing all through the years. And you know, everything comes to an end, and you got to stop and smell the roses before they're growing on you at some point.
Can you sum up a design credo, a personal credo for yourself?
I don't know. Define credo to me, and then I'll...
Oh, the principles that you've stood by and worked by all these...
Well, I don't know. I guess it really starts with people. I mentioned this a couple of times, but I've always been... You know, you're only as good as the people that work for you, and if you're good at drawing the best out of people, that talented people that you have, and even some that are not so talented, I've always felt that... You know, give me a guy with a good attitude and maybe not quite so much talent. But unfortunately, going with a guy with a lot of talent comes a prima donna kind of a syndrome. And I've seen so many of those guys that will not compromise. The value of compromise to me is an extremely important thing. I'm not saying sell your soul and, you know, forget about everything you've learned about design and all that stuff. You don't do that, but you can get a lot more with honey than you can with mustard, and you can get a lot more out of your people by treating them as human beings and treating them with the golden rule, and working your activities with them and getting basically what you want, but letting the guy that's working for you feel that he is contributing, and in fact he is, and yet you can still moderate this thing. I think you can still adjust that sort of thing, and yet not have some guy making a threatening phone call in the middle of the night because he hates your guts. And I guess I'd like to be remembered as being a guy that handled people maybe fairly well, and that nobody really hated me. Nobody had a vendetta for me. I don't like to be disliked. Nobody does, I guess. But I've always been particularly sensitive to that. I'd like to treat people and have them treat me the way I like to be treated. And again, to learn the value of compromise and the value of being able to get a lot of what you want without getting somebody mad at you, and being able to convince somebody that maybe you've got a point too, as well as theirs, and maybe you can moderate and not compromise, but adjust that kind of a feeling and get the best of everything for the company that you're working for. Because, you know, unfortunately, if I can go sideways a little bit, the Art Center graduate today, not so much today, a few years back it was more so, but they would get these guys all hyped up and they'd go back to Detroit and design those cars, and don't listen to that bullshit that management's going to give you about, you know, changing your design. Hold your reins and don't let anything, don't compromise, keep what you want. God, I...